All right. I tried. I really tried to start this week being angry positive as opposed to angry negative. Last night, we talked about Canadian success stories, taking on the world with new corporations, new internet platforms, new services. But, you know, you think that maybe there's some reason in the world and that that reason outweighs, see, you get hit with a story that led today or that really threw me for a loop today. The Spanish Prime Minister, who was elected after the terrorist bombings in Madrid killed 200 people, and he felt capitulation was the appropriate measure, a way of response to terror, decided to start a program called the Alliance of Civilizations. This little program, which is under the aegis of the United Nations, released a report. Now, among the 20 scholars that did this report were people like Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa, who won the Nobel Peace Prize, and Mohammed Khatami, the former Iranian president responsible for the savage murder of Montreal photojournalist Zahra Khazami. And the report dealt with the conflict between the West and the Muslim world. And in their sagesse, in their genius, determined that all these problems between the West and the Muslim world are political and not religious, and we really shouldn't pay attention to people like Ahmadinejad when they say that they want to restore a caliphate and sort of get along by going along. This kind of insanity with the UN sanction puts me over the top. And every now and then when I get over the top on the United Nations, there is one voice of reason, and I don't know how she does it, and I'm very pleased that I managed to catch her today to be with us. And that's Anne Bajewski, who's a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute and Natural Law Center, Institute of Human Rights, and runs a great site called eyeontheun.org, and I suggest that you go there. And Anne, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Hi.
So I'm looking at your site, Anne, and you look very calm and relaxed on the site. How do you react to stuff like this? How is this even within the realm of reason in Western civilization?
Well, the UN calls this whole episode a report from the Alliance of Civilizations. I call it the Alliance Against Civilization because this is another UN report which is essentially irrelevant for anyone seriously interested in tolerance. This high-level group that came up with this report, as you say, included the former Iranian president Khatami, who, of course, was president during the murder of Canadian Zahra Khazemi, and was president during the time as Iran pursued nuclear weapons during the biggest crackdown on the Iranian media since the Iranian Revolution, and the rounding up and imprisoning of Jews on various trumped-up charges of spying.
The famous trial of the 13 in 1999-2000.
Exactly. That was his legacy. And so then he's put in charge or as a one of
and,
a few.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but let's not forget, he was also the man who elevated Saeed Murtazawi, the prosecutor of Zahra Khazemi, who beat her over the head with a shoe, cracking her skull, to the position that he now holds, which is observer at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva.
Here we have it. This is what the UN thinks of as it puts in a leadership role to tell us about what it takes to be civilized. So it's hardly surprising that this UN report says that the center of all evil, the root cause of conflict in the world today, the reason why Muslims are so upset is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And as they put it, this colors cross-cultural and political relations among faiths. So why is there this conflict, they say? Oh, well, it doesn't have to do with the fact that Arabs and Muslim states have rejected the existence of Israel since it was founded, but it has to do with this so-called Israeli occupation, which, of course, started it from their terms
and when Kofi
in 1948.
And when Kofi Annan gives his stamp of approval to this, is the world supposed to just forget what Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is saying about restoring a caliphate, about destroying not only Israel, the little Satan, but America, the big Satan? Is all that, what are we supposed to do, just laugh that off?
You have to understand that the United Nations is so far afield these days from anything that it was founded on, but democratic values, period. I mean, the why do they put forward that the root cause of Muslim concern is the Israeli occupation? Because, I mean, I'm quoting Kofi Annan on this particular report. He says that no other conflict carries such an emotional charge among people far removed from the battlefield. Well, I mean, Why are they emotional? Anti-Semites from all over the world get emotional about the existence of a Jewish state. That doesn't mean that we ought to cater to that kind of emotion. We ought to call it for what it is. It's just base anti-Semitism. But let's remember here, right as we speak, the UN is now adopting, this week and next, 25 resolutions demonizing the state of Israel, but not a single one on Sudan. They're not even putting one forward on Sudan because it wouldn't get adopted. There are three resolutions on children's rights now at the United Nations. One on children's rights everywhere in the world, one on the rights of the girl child, and the third on Lebanese children that are said to be the victims of Israel.
Yet I'm sure that none of these resolutions address the status of women or the status of children under Sharia law in Arab countries.
No, the resolutions on women's rights, the new ones on women's rights, now talk about foreign occupation. But tomorrow there'll be the third special session of the new so-called Reformed Human Rights Council, in which Canada sits, and it's going to have another special session on Israel in its first 6 months of existence, but no special session on Darfur is even possible because the Organization of Islamic Conference took over the new Human Rights Council.
Anne, can you stay with us for a few more minutes? We just have to take a short break.
Sure.
Right, we'll be right back. And we're talking with Anne Bajewski of the Hudson Institute and head of the director of the EyeOnTheUN.org. And you really ought to go to this site if you're as aggravated with the United Nations, as fed up with it as I am. We're talking about this new report from the Alliance for Civilizations that says that all the problems with the Muslim world, with the radical Muslim world, with Islamofascism is really due to political misunderstandings and not to any religious underpinnings for hegemony over the West. You look at the UN so closely, your website is chock filled with stuff that people need to know. What reactions do you get when something like this happens? Or do people just throw up their hands and say, well, hell, this is Anan. I mean, this is the guy who protected his son in oil for food. This is the guy who let hundreds of thousands die in Rwanda when he was head of peacekeeping. And what do you like this?
Listen, the UN, the American taxpayer pays 22% of the regular budget of the United Nations. $0.3 billion were spent last year from the United States to the United Nations. And sooner or later, probably later, given the change of the political scene here, they are asking questions about where their money's going. And it's not just that it's misspent and that there's corruption. It's that it's a dangerous place. The UN foments a deep resentment of democratic countries. If this report, for example, says that one of the problems is the perception of double standards, application of human rights law, felt by many Muslims around the globe. In other words, they don't actually believe that there ought to be universal standards, good
right,
for everybody everywhere, but that somehow the culture and religion exempts them from the equal treatment of minorities and other groups. But I can't.
And they believe that because for them religion and politics are the same thing.
Well, I must say I have to ask one. There's a problem with Canada, which I think we have to recognize. In the province of Ontario, we continue to have a law where public education, of course, is funded by or religious school education, day school education, is funded by the government of Ontario, and Catholics get 100% of school funding from the age of, from preschool to the end of grade 12.
Right.
And every other religion in the province of Ontario gets nothing. That's Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, Protestants, etc. So, you know, Canada holds itself up as a perfect place to live in terms of the environment. And we got to make sure that we look ourselves straight in the mirror. But having said that, we don't hold a candle to what goes on in Iran, which is interesting because right at this very moment, Canada is putting forward a resolution on the horrible human rights violations in Iran at the General Assembly. And how did Iran respond? It actually has put forward a resolution on human rights violations in Canada. and that will come to a vote in the next couple of weeks. The United States put one forward on Belarus, and Belarus responded by putting one forward on the terrible state of democracy in the United States. So the situation at the UN
is this really a time? Is this really a time? You know, when I see Khatami's name, I recall in the past month, we at the Institute have helped dissident groups in L.A. and Toronto protest his visit in Washington. We helped legal groups in London serve him with a subpoena at St. Andrews University. We just finished a conference on the status of women under Islamic law with Wafa Sultan and Nani Darwish and Nazanin Afsanjan, talking particularly about Iran and Bridget Gabriel. And we had people in the streets demonstrating. This is a time for people to stand up and say, okay, you know, the UN, the time is over for discussion. You guys are beyond the pale. Is it really a time for people to stand up and say, enough, just get out, close the doors?
Well, of course, the biggest threat facing us all is the acquisition by Iran of nuclear weapons. And we'll unfortunately be long gone as a civilization, civilized society anywhere, starting with Israel, of course, after Iran acquires nuclear weapons. And given its track record with Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations, and of course it's a major state the major state sponsor of terrorism. And the United Nations Security Council, sitting there on Iran, can't pass a resolution with any sort of serious sanctions. I mean, we may eventually have a kind of a rap on the knuckles, but it's not taking the matter in hand. And Iran is emboldened, and we are
feckless.
Well, we are using the United Nations as an excuse to adopt a strategy of democratic societies working together to save themselves from literally destruction. And as long as the UN is the center point for foreign policy for democracies anywhere, we are in very serious trouble.
Well, I know a lot of high-ranking Tories listen to this show, and Anne Baevsky is a Canadian, and boy, there couldn't be a better voice for Canada at the UN than you.
Well, so we have to wait and see how Canada's going to vote, by the way, on these 25 resolutions.
Well, if you're at the UN, I'd feel a lot better, but I have a lot of faith in this Prime Minister, so we'll see. Anne Baevsky, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Take care. We'll be right back. For those of you out there who are regular listeners, you know that I don't hold too much store by polls and polling. I don't think the country should be led by it. And so often they're wrong in any case that your vote shouldn't be decided by it. But one of the rare, the company called SES Research, and their site is chock full of stuff you need to know. You should go to it, sesresearch.com. And its president is Nick Nanos, and he's just released a tremendously interesting poll that shows that liberals may be descending on Montreal in numbers to elect a new leader, but it may have no impact on what Canadians are thinking today. Reason to pay attention to what Nick Nanos has to say is that for the past several elections, they have been within a point to a point and a half of what the numbers really were. Nick Nanos, thanks for being so patient. We had the breaking story in New York, and it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm looking at this poll, and the poll, what you did was you asked voters their intentions based on who the leader was going to be. So Ignatieff is Liberal leader, Ray is Liberal leader, Dion is Liberal leader, Kennedy is Liberal leader. And the greatest percentage of reaction was no impact on their vote, ranging from 42% to 50%. What does that tell you?
Well, I think what it tells us is that there isn't really what I'll say a star candidate really to excite people, and that none of the above is doing really well. This is kind of a mixed bag for the Liberals, because for many of the candidates, just as many they'd attract just as many people as they would repel, depending on when they're leader. So this leadership convention is going to be very important for whoever wins to kind of use it as a platform to try to get some momentum. But right now, I don't think a lot of Canadians are tuning into the Liberal leadership.
And you did this survey across the board with NDP voters, Bloc voters, and Tory voters.
Yeah, we completed the survey last Thursday night. A couple interesting things is that, Bob Rae does have some traction, big surprise, among New Democratic supporters, that if he was the leader, he would have appeal to those voters that voted NDP in the last election. He could probably pick up some extra votes on that front. And, we know in 2004, strategic voting allowed the Liberals to just hang on by their fingernails onto that minority government that Paul Martin formed. So, Bob Rae does have that in his favor. But, the flip side to that is that among conservative voters, Bob Rae's just not on. He basically has like a score of minus 20 among voters that voted conservative in the last election.
And among Liberal voters?
Well, among liberal voters, he's basically, he does have a little bit of a draw. About 32% of committed liberal voters are more likely to vote liberal, but he would lose 27%. So it's a bit of a trade-off.
Is it not telling about the political intelligence of Canadians that here they've got a guy like Bob Rae, who was NDP in Ontario, left Ontario in a financial basket case, backed by the biggest of big business, perceived by NDP voters as an acceptable candidate?
Well, it's just one of those things where, you know, we know from our polling, we also polled Canadians on how comfortable or uncomfortable they were with the idea of a Stephen Harper majority government. And, you know, the numbers were pretty good for the Conservatives, except for one group, New Democrats. One out of every two committed New Democrats are very concerned about a Stephen Harper majority government. And that's bad news for Jack Layton, because, you know, that means that a good part of his vote, half of his vote,
around. They could do what Buzz Hargrove asked them to do and leave the NDP and vote Liberal in certain ridings?
Exactly. Especially if there's any kind of situation where Stephen Harper gets close to forming majority government. It's just going to scare New Democrats.
Have the numbers been holding on the Tory side through the summer and the fall?
Well, what we have, the Tory numbers have been holding fairly well in Atlantic Canada, in Ontario, and they've been doing very well in the West in British Columbia. But they've been having a problem during the summer in Quebec. You know, what we found in the numbers in Quebec, when the Conservatives talked about ethics in government and cutting taxes and domestic issues, the numbers in Quebec went very well for the Conservatives. But when they start talking about not participating in Kyoto or withdrawing from Kyoto, talking about Afghanistan, having lots of pictures with George W. Bush,
right,
the Conservative numbers have just softened. So, you know, I think the message for Stephen Harper is, you know, talk domestic politics. You know, it's good for his numbers in Quebec. But, you know, as soon as he gets drawn into the foreign policy, it's just a very slippery slope for him.
I like the way you phrase that. You phrase in a positive way. Talk domestic politics as opposed to compromising what you're saying on foreign policy.
Yeah.
Stephen Harper is not a man who's going to compromise on anything. But, you know, most spin doctors would say, go to the negative. You've just said it in a very positive way, which I think could be a good piece of advice.
Well, I think for the average voter, you know, we have to face it. In the last election, the Liberals were tired. Canadians saw Stephen Harper. They're willing to give him a try, and they're waiting to see how he's going to do. So, you know, when he makes progress on things like cutting the GST and ethics in government and the Accountability Act and his crime package, he gets the nod on it. But you know, that's what Canadians want to see. They want to see more of that. Because, you know, there wasn't a lot of talk about foreign policy in the last federal election, I'll tell you that much. And I think foreign policy might be a sleep issue in this upcoming election. Canadian elections very rarely are fought on foreign policy. Usually it's domestic issues. And, you know, we're going to be having casualties during the writ period, and who knows what else will happen. So it's going to be very tricky.
Nick, I know we're tight evening. Can you stay with us for a few more minutes after the break, or are you really tight for time?
I've got another couple minutes.
Okay, thanks a lot. We'll be right back with Nick Nanos, sesresearch.com. Montreal, we'll be right back. The issue we've discussed tonight, this ridiculous United Nations report that says the Islamofascism we're facing is mostly political, not religious in nature. Does the Liberal Party have anything to say to you at its recent in its upcoming convention? We're talking to Nick Nanos of SES Research, one of the most on-the-button polling outfits out there, sesresearch.com. They've just released a poll that shows, well, regardless of who the leader is, really 50% of the people out there won't have an impact on their vote. Nick, let me ask you a couple of final questions. Does this mean that the Liberal Party... No, let me rephrase that. Does this mean that liberalism, smaller liberalism, is classically defined as expansion of opportunity, as the state not being in our hair all the time. Has that mandate been co-opted by the small-c conservatism of Stephen Harper, and the liberals have been pushed sort of what Ray Hurd would call the socialist left, and that's why they're pushing the NDP, because they have nowhere else to go?
See, what I would say is this is just about straight power, not about ideology. For, you know, I think for a lot of liberals, and even the liberals that are going to go into the, you know, their convention, they're going to be picking someone who they think can win. And if they think they can win by kind of nibbling into the NDP support, then they're going to move in that direction. And, you know, I think, you know, the liberals kind of are very soft on ideology, and I think that's one of the reasons why Stephen Harper has had some appeal. You know, what we find in our polling is that Canadians reward consistency. They might not like what somebody says. They might not agree with what that person says, but if they're consistent, they like that.
You anticipated my next question, because some of your polling has shown that Stephen Harper may not, you know, his message may not resonate everywhere, but everybody gives him points for integrity and sticking to his program. And from the liberals, we're not hearing about a program or ideas.
If you notice, you know, when Stephen Harper's kind of taking shots at the liberals, it's usually in the flip-flop thing. When it comes to, you know, Middle Eastern politics, that they're divided and they don't know what they're doing and they're changing their position, or whatever their position is on accountability and so forth. So he's looking at trying to frame himself as consistent versus the liberals potentially as being inconsistent. And, you know, I think that's one potential vulnerability for Bob Rae, because, you know, he was a New Democrat, now he's a liberal. You know, it's going to allow Stephen Harper an opening to say, well, he's a liberal today, he was a New Democrat yesterday, tomorrow, who knows what he's going to be. But I think that's kind of the key thing is consistency, because, you know, we have a lot of complex issues, and when Canadians see a consistent leader, that's usually rewarded. You know, that was Mike Harris's recipe in Ontario. The polling showed that not everybody agreed with what he had to do, and they were uncomfortable. But they knew what he was going to do. They could anticipate
So a lot of people have said that, you know, running against Bob Rae is almost Stephen Harper's wet dream. But if we're talking about consistency, then Michael Ignatieff wouldn't be that bad either.
Well, exactly. And, you know, the thing is that in a lot of the elections in Canada, they're not necessarily won, but they're lost. You know, granted, in the last election, the Conservatives ran a good campaign, but let's face it, the Liberals blew up, and the Conservatives managed to step in. So, you know, I think for anyone, you know, I think the two key things for the Liberals coming out of this convention, can they elect a leader who's surrounded by advisors who won't make the big mistakes when it comes time to the next federal election? And can the party come out united? Because if it doesn't come out united and it's a real dogfight in that convention and it's very divided, that's going to be a signal to Canadians that, you know, the Liberals are not necessarily ready for prime time yet.
Nick, final question.
Yep.
How the heck have you and your company and your gang been so close on the numbers so many times in the past few elections? I mean, nobody's matched this.
Well, we pay a lot of attention to detail, and, you know, most of the polling companies do a very good job, and, you know, we just it's like anyone, whether you're
is it your sample being wider, or is it your questions being broader?
It's a combination of things. We spend a lot of time on the quality control of the way we do our field work, and we spend a lot of time on the questions. You know what? After we finished the last election, we were very close. We were the closest.
Yep,
we were bang
you
on.
Were.
We still looked at how could we make it better, and you know, you just got to keep working it. It's like any other job. Got to have pride in what you're doing and pay attention to detail.
Well, Nick, we thank you very much for your patience, and more than anything, we thank you very much for your wisdom.
My pleasure.
Take care, Montreal.
Okay,
will be right back. Well, Nick Nanos is one of this country's dead-on pollsters, and he's telling us that the Liberal Party may not have much to say to Canadians anymore. And our next guest, as you regular listeners know, is the political columnist that I think calls it as it is and calls them dead-on, Angelo Persichelli, who is a columnist for the Hill Times. And I suggest you go to his website, persichelli.com, P-E-R-S-I-C-H-I-L-L-I.com. And was suggested in two recent articles that maybe one of the reasons is the Liberals don't know what this country is anymore and they can't see the mirror of it. Welcome, Angelo.
Hi, how are you?
Well, you... So we got saying Liberals may not have much to say to this country. You've been writing... I just got to read up part of a fierce paragraph. Angelo Persichelli writes, the fact that the last two Liberal ministers of immigration, Judy Zgro and Joe Volpe, proposed to their government a program to deal with the undocumented immigrants, and their proposals were stopped by the cabinet. When they asked their colleagues in caucus to put pressure on their government to allow the reform, their requests were completely ignored by the same MPs who now are assaulting the Conservative government for not doing what they did not do in 13 years. And what a coincidence, the only time that the national media wrote about the last two Liberal ministers of immigration was involved. What's worse than a wrong policy or no policy? Only one thing. Hypocrisy. But you go further than that in an article you wrote in the Toronto Sun, Minorities Are Actually the Majorities, in analyzing that maybe the reason why they haven't been able to unglue themselves on immigration policies, the Liberal Party, is that they've been treating immigration policy as sort of bones you throw to minorities in the country. Except the argument you're making now is, hey, the minorities are no longer the minorities. And this is not John Porter's beautiful vertical mosaic anymore. Times have changed.
Well, there is a bit of a confusion with the policy that they think, they say they have invented. So there are three steps. You have immigration, which is the policy that brings new people into this country. Then you have multiculturalism that helps them to integrate into the country, becoming Canadian, period. I think that there is a step missing between immigration and becoming Canadian. And there are many people believing that we are welcome as long as we are immigrants for all our life. And I believe that this kind of a reality, it's settling with certain people on the top, especially in the Liberal Party, that are not able to adjust to the new reality that people are not immigrants anymore. And so they are lost. They don't know what to say. They don't know what to do. And they are completely confused with immigration, which is the policy that makes and ask and allows new Canadians to come into the country, and multiculturalism and communication and media that should be the instrument to make them Canadian, that they are all disconnected. So everybody is going to interpret all those policies the way they want. My friend, it's a mess.
Is this because, and I asked Nick Nanas this question, is this because the Liberals have for decades taken it for granted that ethnics, minorities, visible or not, will vote for them and they could give things out as gifts to them while they, as the elites, will control everything? And all of a sudden they turn around and, as you point out in your column, 43% of Toronto's population reported themselves as being part of a visible minority. And if we add all the, quote, ethnics, say Portuguese, Italian, Greek, Polish, people of German origin, that total rises to 70%. So the Liberal Party can no longer address them as noblesse oblige, here's a little gift from the elites. They now have to go sort of toe-to-toe and equal with them. And the small-C conservatism and Main Street conservatism as opposed to Bay Street liberalism meet that criteria better?
Well, you know, the point is that when we talk, when we use terms and we attach a semantic to those terms, that means completely different. For example, we say ethnic, and we know who they are, but we know who we assume they are. And then we have to ask ourselves, who are the non-ethnics? And then you have to wonder, because nobody defines. So officially, everybody is part of a cultural group. And officially, you have the ethnics and the non-ethnics, that meaning the Anglophones, the Francophones, the Aboriginals. For example, the Toronto Star, they are writing a story every time there is an election. They write stories trying to find out how the ethnics vote, for who. So the first mistake, I don't know if it's a mistake, that's exactly
a misconception.
Yeah, they are bunching us all together, saying the ethnics, how they vote. And then they start looking, well, you know, they ghettoize themselves because they vote only for their own. Second mistake, because, and I explain briefly later. And then...
Angelo, if I could ask you to be patient, hold the third mistake. We just got to take a short break. Okay, we'll be right back
absolutely.
With Angelo Persichelli. And with Angeli about the problem with the way political parties perceive such a thing left, and particularly the liberal policies on them. You were talking about mistakes that were made in ethics, and I had stopped you before you got to the third one.
Yes, and the third mistake is when they start talking about ghettoizing, and the people are, the ethnics are voting for themselves, and that is a little problem when they talk, you know, the third mistake when they talk about minorities. I was mentioning, you were mentioning Toronto. Well, 70%, that is a little problem. So with the word ethnic, they offend the meaning of the policy of multiculturalism. But with the word minority, they offend mathematics, the rules of mathematics. 70%
yeah.
Is not. So the way, when they say, well, the ethnics vote for themselves, then we have 70%. But if you look, for example, the city of Toronto, how many minorities, ethnics, are in the city hall? So there is something missing there. Now, first of all, the so-called ethnics, they, we have voted for everybody because we never had a candidate at the beginning. So we were used to vote for the non-ethnics, or should I say the Francophones in Quebec and the Anglophones in Ontario. That's the bottom line, right? We have voted for everybody. Now, they are starting to say that we vote just for us, which is not true. The question is, will they vote for the ethnics? And we remember, which never mind Jacques Parizeau and all the other stuff. But the question is, why they want to have a poll, why they want to write a story saying, let's see how the ethnics...
Well, here's what I think.
Why don't write a story, and say how the Francophones vote,
That's exactly what you anticipate exactly what I was going to say. In the last municipal election, the island of Montreal, for the first time, was more than 50% non-Francophone. It redefines, as you say, what is an ethnic. On the island of Montreal right now, a minority are the Francophones. But worse than that, the politicians are really lost, and particularly the Liberals, because instead of treating everybody equally and respecting everybody equally, they've played the politics of divide and conquer. They've played the politics of the lowest common denominator, of setting one group against another for so long, they don't know what to do anymore.
Well, you know, there is a lot of confusion out there. I remember before the leadership race started, the member for Bourassa, I think, Denico, there was saying that in order to become a leader of the Liberal Party, you have to know much more than the French language. You have to be part of the culture. You have to know the culture, and you have to be part of the culture. So does it mean that if you are, when we talk about multiculturalism, we are talking about maintaining the own culture? You know, can we elaborate on that? Does it mean that multiculturalism automatically excludes you from being running for the leadership of the Liberal Party?
Does it mean that multiculturalism only gives you a little opening into the door of Canada, a little taste, a little smell, but it never allows you to be a fully participating member?
Well, I try to suspect that that's exactly the case.
I was startled by a story in your Toronto Sun article where you discuss your experience at Rideau Hall at a swearing-in ceremony of the Paul Martin government, and somebody asked you, did you count your ministers, meaning the Italian ministers? And it's amazing how this collectivist thinking in Canada is so pervasive. 10 days ago, I was leading a demonstration supporting our troops, just supporting our troops. And after a 10-minute conversation with the CBC French RDI reporter, CBC French radio reporter, out of nowhere, she says, "Are you Jewish?" I said, "What the hell is that going to do with anything? Are you Catholic?" It's as if Canadians can't accept that individuals have the capacity to assimilate information and make their own decisions without the benediction of collectivities, nor can politicians adapt to a electorate that has the base intelligence to make decisions without reference to the group.
But this is the point. You know, even if it was a joke, my colleague was asking and asked, "Are you counting the Italian ministers?" Now, keeping in mind that quite a few of them were born in Canada, had nothing to do with
it. He shouldn't have had it in his mind.
But, you know, the question is, and seems normal. You know, it's a joke, but it's normal. But
it's a joke of small-mindedness, of low limitation and meanness.
Yeah, but we should start asking questions. Can we count how many Anglophone ministers we have?
That's what we should do.
Well, you know, we have to count them. If they want to count, quote-unquote, you know, my ministers, I want to count them, theirs.
A book was written about 15 years ago in the United States called The Rise of the Unmeltable Ethnics, and the conclusion of that book was, there's not going to be any ethnics anymore. It's les autres, the others, that are going to control things. And you put your finger right on it, as you so often do. Angela Persichelli, I want to thank you for being with us tonight. And,
when
Wilfrid Laurier said that this country answers to a higher destiny, it was not the destiny of low limitation and meanness of spirit and narrow circumstance. As William Jennings Bryan said, destiny is no matter of chance. It is a matter of choice. It is not a thing to be waited for. It is a thing to be achieved. It is yet to be seen whether this country can fulfill its potential and achieve it. Thank you, listeners, and good night. Thank you to Nick Mays and Master Control. We'll be back with you tomorrow.